You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 8th of February 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme, as the United Kingdom nears the Brexit cliff edge, we'll ask if its people, not its government, are the ones to help get it out of its own mess. My guests, Robin Lustig and Stephanie Bolton, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including...
As members of Congress, we have a moral responsibility to act now to protect Dreamers who are the pride of our nation and are American in every way, but on paper.
Just a... very small segment of Nancy Pelosi's marathon 8-hour speech to the House of Representatives. We'll be asking if that marathon oration even tells half the story of the nation's thorny relationship with its young dreamers. And we'll also be discussing whether the political dream might slowly be coming to an end for Angela Merkel in Germany. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A warm welcome to Midori House. My guests today are indeed Robin Lustig, journalist and broadcaster, and Stephanie Bolton, London correspondent for Die Welt. Welcome both to the programme. Good to have you with us. Here, UK government ministers have been in intensive discussions this week, finally, to try to figure out the shape of things to come for the country's future dealings with Europe. The conclusion so far seems to be something close to... dunno. One group of Britons are taking the initiative, though. A group of the 46,000 UK citizens in the Netherlands are fighting in the Dutch courts to retain their EU citizenship. Despite the actions of the UK, the case has been allowed to progress further to the European Court. If it did turn out to be successful, the issue of UK citizens born in the EU, i.e. all of them, poses a thorny issue, shall we say, for Brexiteers in Westminster. Stephanie, are court cases like that one, just one, of the dozens or scores or hundreds of sort of real-world hurdles that the Brexit vote simply failed to foresee?
Exactly. I mean, it is one of the many, many, many questions that will be raised. There will be many legal cases. Now, this one is about EU citizenship. Mm. There are more legal cases in Ireland. There is, of course, the question about the Northern Irish border, which is not, there's no solution for it. How can you say we want to leave the European Union with all its consequences up, but we're not going to have a border? I mean, this is just one of those things. And I find this very, the Dutch case is very, very interesting because, in fact, these people have been taken away their citizenship. They are going to lose their EU citizenship. And that's something that obviously Brexiteers who were advocating for leaving the European Union probably never thought about.
Robin, why was there such a chronic inability from, let's be fair, virtually everyone involved in this, all the stakeholders, to ask some very, you know, germane questions about things like the border or the status of these individuals? They seem so obvious, and yet we're only asking them so many months after we voted to leave.
It's sad, isn't it? I mean, I think everybody agrees now that the debate that preceded the referendum was pretty awful. There were dozens of questions that simply weren't asked. Partly, I think, because the debate largely was ideological and cultural rather than economic and social. But there is another issue, which is this whole idea of EU citizenship. I'm not entirely comfortable with the idea of EU citizenship because, to me, being a citizen means being a citizen of a nation state. And the EU is not a nation state. Now, I have an immense amount of sympathy, both for the British citizens who are living in other EU countries and for those people from other EU countries who are living in the UK. They don't know what the future holds for them. These are real individual stories which affect individuals and families. Nevertheless, let's look at these British citizens in the Netherlands. They have two choices already available to them. They could take out Dutch citizenship, if they wished to do that. Or the Dutch government could say, we will, regardless of any deal done on Brexit, give Dutch citizenship or EU citizenship of our own volition to British people who are living overseas. It's not something personally which I would like to see a European court adjudicate on. I think it's up to individual governments and individual nations to decide who is a citizen of their country.
I think that's a very fair point, but wasn't one of the whole points that was enshrined even in the Lisbon Treaty, the idea that the EU citizenship was conferred as citizenship in addition to whatever your nationhood was, and that it therefore sort of accumulated similar rights as a citizen would? I mean, that may be a semantic point,
Of course you're right.
But the idea being you can't just strip it away.
Well, that's the issue which courts are going to have to decide, because we Brits became EU citizens when the UK signed up to the Lisbon Treaty and as a full member of the EU. If the UK decides democratically in a referendum that it no longer wishes to be a member of the EU, then it's not entirely surprising that certain rights that came with EU membership then fall to one side.
Stephanie, I don't actually know the numbers off the top of my head, and I'm not going to test you on this, but in terms of Brits in the similar situation in Germany, for example, but one imagines that, again, there'll be quite a conversation to be had in the corridors of power in whichever of the other 27 about, precisely as Robin says, they should confer, whether it be EU or German or whatever, status on those citizens. Is that a... I don't know, how delicate a decision is that for politicians to make?
It is delicate, and I think it's also a bit generational. I don't share your attitude to that. I quite like the idea of being German and on top of this being European citizen. And I myself, I only realised that the other day, I mean, we are actually thinking, I have been a Brussels correspondent for many years. I should actually know that. I was thinking, oh, well, I can always have the British and the German citizenship. And I would like to have it because I am German. I want to stay German. But I'm living in the UK, I'm raising my children here, paying my taxes, I would actually like to vote. But now I won't be able to anymore, because if I ask for British citizenship, I have to give up German citizenship, because as a German, I'm not allowed to have two passports. So it brings me in the same situation. For me, citizenship is more abstract. It's where I live and where I can have my rights. And I have a completely different philosophy about that, which I think is a generational question.
It may be. I mean, to me, a citizen is somebody who owes a loyalty to a nation, who pays their taxes to a government. The EU is not a nation. And I think one of the reasons there has been this antipathy towards the EU by certain people here in the UK is that they didn't like the idea that the EU was pretending to be a nation. They wanted the UK to be their nation. They didn't, you know, our passports say European Union on the top, as well as United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. I personally have no objection to that, but I understand those people who do.
It's such a difficult question, because obviously if you go back to the very founding principles of the idea of a European bloc and these kind of alliances, you get into that vexed question of, you know, the great conflicts of the 20th century and so on. And I find the idea, Stephanie, that it is a generational thing particularly hard to grasp, because the older people perhaps that you're referring to there would surely have the most immediate memory of precisely what profound divisions and extreme nationalism in Europe can deliver. So I always found it hard, even when we know that older demographic was quite pro-Brexit broadly in this country. I found that hard because I couldn't understand how they had such a short memory. But am I missing the point?
I think it's more the time and circumstances you are raised in. So probably my parents would also find it difficult to have two nationalities, and I'm sure they don't even think about that. They also have a European passport. But for my generation, I'm not that young, but for us, we are kind of the first generation that grew up with things like Erasmus. I grew up close to the Dutch border, and I remember the days when we had to cross the border and there were checks, and then suddenly the checks were gone. And nowadays we just cross the borders. It's a Euroregio, as you call it. It's a joint economic area, and you can study over the border. And it's something that is so natural to me, and even more to my nieces and nephews and my kids one day, that I just find it so unnecessary.
Indeed. Well, my son's going to have his Irish passport application is in, so he'll still be able to enjoy all of those fruits, which I'm very glad about, because that would be something that I would
find hard to deal with. Yeah, and I think it's a shame that British kids will not be able to enjoy and have the same privileges as German kids.
Well, here's a question for you, Robin. Will they? Because the more we talk about this, and the more these huge, often seemingly intractable questions and hurdles present themselves, the more I think, as an avowed sort of Europhile, well, hang on a minute. The more of these there come, the more delays, the more infighting in the UK, the more likely that somebody at some point just says, look, we can't do this. Is that Where do you stand on that notion?
There's no real evidence yet that the mood has changed significantly. There are a few straws in the wind that some people are beginning to have second thoughts. The problem, I think, politically in the UK is that both the major parties are split down the middle on this issue. Neither of the major political parties has a clear line. You referred in your introduction to the British government really still in a position of, oh dear. The Labour Party's in the same
position. I'm not sure it's as coherent as that, actually.
Maybe not. the Labour Party is no better. So it's really hard to see how we are going to get out of this mess. And I personally think it's going to be really, really hard.
Stephanie, let me ask you about that point that Robin alludes to there, which is the government and its handling or mishandling or just kind of ongoing silence on this. Do you recall in your years of watching Westminster and being in London any similar point where we just reach this sort of, it's not even an impasse, there just seems to be nothing. There's no strategy. We're hearing now, Theresa May wants to take all her senior team off to Chequers and talk about things behind closed doors. I mean, I know of no comparison to this. Now, perhaps that's because there hasn't been anything like this politically. But can you recall a political moment of such, failure?
I haven't been here long enough to remember that, but from everything I hear from people who have been living here all life, and you will know much better, there hasn't been anything like this. And
it's
the face of the biggest challenge post-war that the UK is facing. And the problem is there was a binary question on the most complex issue that actually you can ask a citizen, and they gave an answer. It was very, very tight. And that's the dilemma. And on top of this, you have a prime minister who's very weak because she can't make up her mind. She's not a strong leader. And she just can't get the troops behind her, whether it's for a soft Brexit or a hard Brexit. She just can't make up her mind. And that's probably the weakness and the biggest challenge now for...
I have quite a long political memory. And I think Britain is now in the biggest political crisis that it's been in since Suez in the 1950s. And what happened after the Suez debacle, when the British, and together with the French and the Israelis, tried to seize control of the Suez Canal and failed, the then Prime Minister was booted out in no short order and replaced. Now, for some reason, the Conservative Party in its present state isn't able to do that with, as you say, an extremely weak Prime Minister, Theresa May, who doesn't know which way to turn, who appears unable to keep her own government in any kind of check. They're running in all kinds of directions at once, and we're just in a system, a state of... It's either stalemate or chaos. I don't know if you can have a chaotic stalemate, but that's where we are.
I didn't think you could, but seemingly...
Well, indeed
you can, if that's what we have, for sure. From Theresa May, let's turn to a politician who seemingly... Well, it certainly appears that she knew exactly what she wanted to be saying. Democrat politician Nancy Pelosi delivered what's thought to be the longest speech in US political history, 8 hours in the House of Representatives. Her marathon oration told the stories of Dreamers, the name given to undocumented migrants who arrived in the US as children and have been allowed to stay until now. Possibly. The Trump administration wants to overturn the policy. Pelosi, along with many other US citizens, seemingly has a lot to say about it. Well, a huge amount
eight
to say, Robin.
Worth.
Before we come on to the dynamics of her speech, Robin, why is the US, we've said this before, a nation built on immigration, having this conversation with such vigour now? Is it purely because of the incumbent in the Oval Office?
It's largely to do, I think, with the fact that one of Donald Trump's main campaign mantras was that he was going to do something about immigration, particularly illegal immigration. It is a well-known fact that there are millions and millions of people, mainly from Central and South America, who entered the United States illegally. Without them, the US economy would grind to a standstill. Not a single garden in California would be looked after. Not a single farm would have its crops picked. Nevertheless, there is a feeling in a significant part of the US electorate that there are too many illegal / undocumented migrants. Therefore, Donald Trump says, I'm going to get rid of them. And that includes the dreamers, the children, because he seemed to feel that a lot of the migrants were coming in confident in the knowledge that their children at least would have a decent future in the US. But there's something more going on, if I can just say this quickly. This is part of Donald Trump's transactional approach to politics. I don't think he cares that much about dreamers. What he cares about is this absurd idea of building a wall along the Mexican border. Democrats won't let him have his wall because they won't fund it. So he's saying, if you want me to allow allow the Dreamers to stay, then give me my money for the wall. It's as simple as that. I know what you want. You want. You know what I want. Let's deal. It's a card in that game.
And it's a depressing reality. And excuse me, Stephanie, it strikes me as a sort of strange comparison with what we were just talking about vis the EU. These children, or you know, the Dreamers who arrived as children, there was sort of a tacit understanding that the traditional principles of US democracy, the welcoming, the fact that everyone was equal and everyone had an opportunity, did it apply to them? In the same way, I guess that some of these EU citizens signed up to that broader idea. I want to be part of this project. And in the same way, it looks like it can, you know, the rug can be pulled out from under their feet in one fell swoop. Do you think, whether it's Pelosi's record-breaking orations, is there a voice of reason in the US to be heard on this issue?
Yes, of course there is, and there's lots, and whether it's in the Democratic Party or also in the Republican Party. But that's unfortunately not the question. The question is who is now in power, and it's somebody who's very cynical and who's just talking about trade-offs. I agree, he's not interested in really in the destiny. He said in the State of the Union speech, he said Americans are also dreamers. And I mean, this is the kind of rhetoric that plays very much to his electorate, I think. They feel neglected. They have been neglected for decades. They have been seeing the economy around them crumbling, losing their jobs. They feel they have not been appreciated. And finally, there's someone in the White House who gives them back feeling of pride, feeling of a nation, feeling of identity. And it coincides with, apparently, as far as I know, the economy going better. People, I mean, there was some very good coverage, I thought, by the BBC during the State of the Union, where they went into the Trump country and people were very happy and they were very content with a year on what Trump has done for them. And he seems to be like an efficient leader. And that's what you find all over, whether in Eastern Europe or in the US. It's the yearning for somebody who says what's right and what's wrong and takes you there.
And is there a similar short-sightedness with some of those advocates of Brexit, say here in the UK, that there may be a short-term gain politically for them, or a perception of some gain for them politically, but in the longer term, those areas in this country that were most enthusiastically endorsed quitting the EU, in parts of the Northeast or whatever it might be, look to be the places that are going to suffer the most in the medium term? And presumably the same is true in the States. If there are more stringent controls on immigration, those pockets of, you know, Rust Belt or old industrial towns, places where, you know, the coal trade has left, they enthusiastically endorse Trump. Sure, they're enjoying a reasonably solid economic growth now, probably the foundations laid by the Obama administration. But once things bite, which they probably will, they are going to be the ones that suffer, not the Trumps of this world, who are on Wall Street and will probably make it come rain or shine.
But who will they blame when that happens?
Well, I presume...
They won't blame Trump.
Will they not, though?
No. I don't think they will. I think they will blame the bankers. They will blame the fat cats. They will blame the foreigners, all of whom have conspired, quote-unquote, against them. The one thread that runs through Brexit, Trump, and what's happening in Central and Eastern Europe, that great phrase of Trump's, make America great again, the Brexit phrase, bring back control.
Control, yeah. It's
the
control.
Hungary, the Orban phrase, Hungary for Hungarians. It's the same appeal to nationalism, to self-interest, suspicion of, stroke hatred of the foreigners.
So just a quick word on Pelosi, Robin. Not filibustering, DACA bustering, they've
called
it.
Quite impressive. I mean, she's 77 years old.
And she's allowed.
She was wearing high-heeled shoes, apparently. Yeah.
Just
spoke without
a break. But the previous record, as I understand it, was James Champ Clark from 1909, a mere 5 hours 15.
What a wimp.
Impressive.
Women are just stronger.
Yeah. Well, it definitely seems that
women
way.
Women are stronger.
It's remarkable. I mean, these things don't matter a damn, of course, how long somebody speaks for, and I'm glad I didn't have to listen to it. But nevertheless, it's an impressive political gesture. And look, it's got us talking about the issue, which we probably wouldn't have been had she not stood there for 8 hours. I take my hat off to her. I think it's amazing.
Indeed. You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards, Stephanie Bolton and Robin Lustig. Up next, Germany now has nearly a government, but will it be led by Angela Merkel for the foreseeable future? Stay tuned.
Visit our online shop where you can find items designed by our in-house team and collaborations with the brands that we love. Discover everything from luggage and clothes to stationery and back issues of the magazine, as well as our book series and popular travel guides. We deliver worldwide and offer high-quality customer service And don't forget to let us know if you're a Monocle subscriber to enjoy your 10% discount. Go to monocle.com/shop and browse away. Or if you're in Tokyo, Singapore, Hong Kong, London, New York or Toronto, visit us at one of our shops and we'll take care of you personally. See you around!
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me, Stephanie Bolton and Robin Lustig. Now, after months of cross-party wrangling, Germany's Conservatives, led by Angela Merkel, have finally reached a coalition deal for governing alongside the centre-left Social Democrats. But that doesn't mean everyone is happy. There's discord in Merkel's party over the concessions she's had to make to the left in order to reach the deal. And the SPD is also beset by internal conflicts on the rectitude of another grand coalition, despite the ground gained. Control of the finance and foreign ministries and so on and so forth. Many will be, welcoming the overcoming of a sort of political deadlock, Stephanie. Are we seeing, in a roundabout kind of way, the beginning of the end for the German Chancellor?
Yes, I think so. I mean, that has been the feeling for quite some time. I mean, she has been around now since 2005, so 13 years. It's her fourth mandate. Everybody was kind of expecting. I mean, she even back in the end of 2016, it wasn't even clear if she was going to run in September 2017. And she took a long time to make up her mind, but she felt apparently with so much going on, Brexit and Trump and the wars in Syria, she had to stay because at that point, it was before Macron was elected, Europe felt very weak. And she was seen, and she's not a pretentious person, but she was seen as the only strong European Western leader. So she decided to stay. But now with this coalition being formed, and I must say, I was shocked yesterday when I saw the breaking news about the SPD taking on two ministries, two key ministries. So the Foreign Office and the Finance Ministry. She had to give away so much. And she also had to give away the Home Office to the CSU, which is the sister branch of the CDU, the Bavarian, very conservative branch of the Christian Democrats. That was a complete defeat for her. So it feels a bit like alone in Berlin. She's alone in the chancellery. Of course, she's still the chancellor. She's still the most powerful player there. But we will see how this link between the Foreign Office and the Finance Ministry will play, especially when it comes to Europe and Euro reforms. And how European policies will now evolve with Emmanuel Macron in Paris, who has a lot of ambitious plans and wants to change the Eurozone. It's going to be interesting. One more point, which I also found very interesting yesterday, was that the CSU, the Conservative Bavarian Party, sister party, gets the Home Office. But not only the Home Office, they're getting something, it's called the Heimatministerium. Now, Heimat is not homeland, really. Heimat is a very emotional term in German to say home, to be at home. And I find it a quite stuffy expression, and it's a very conservative principle of identity, of German culture. And now this is in Berlin. Okay, to be fair, it's also about infrastructure and things, but it's about regaining the identity question in the face of a lot of anger about the arrival of so many refugees, the integration of refugees, of all this liberal nonsense of there is no nation. And it's something that Germany will have now to work through. But I think any liberal in Germany climbs up the wall with the idea of a Heimat ministry now.
Stephanie paints a pretty extraordinary image there, Robin. What do you make of that? Merkel certainly seems from without to be this lonely and isolated figure. It makes me sad to think of her in this sort of garret surrounded by all of these factions. Has she paid too high a price? Could this be a sort of Pyrrhic victory, if you like?
I have very conflicting emotions about this. Part of me just admires her political skill in being able to put together a government at all with the cards that she was dealt after the election. It was not an easy task, as we know from how long it took her. The other is how difficult it is for any democratically elected politician to know when their time is up and to organise some kind of transition. Nearly all of them stay too long. And I think probably it would have been better for Germany if she had handed over a year or 2 years ago, the leadership of her party. Seems to me her main task now is to organise a transition to a post-Merkel era. Because if she stays there until she is kicked out, either by her own coalition partners or by the electorate, then it will be too late. And she really needs to find some way of stepping back step by step to enable somebody else to take over. We in Europe depend very largely on German stability. Mm. If Germany were to go through the kind of paroxysms that certainly the UK has gone through, that many other European nations have gone through, then we'd be in very serious trouble indeed. We need Germany to remain stable. To use a British political expression, strong and stable.
Don't bring that back up again, please. Stephanie, on that point, it's interesting. You know, you see the post-Merkel conservative movement. I know there are one or two people presumably sort of jockeying for positions, but again, looking from without, there don't seem to be the kind of Macron-esque galvanising characters or unity figures. That could be completely wrong, of course. But then interestingly, also you look more to the left and we know that the Social Democrats are also riven by divides. Now, they've made some pretty extraordinary gains. Nevertheless, the party was unhappy about going back into a grand coalition. The leadership had said, we will be in opposition after the elections. They've gone back on that. Maybe that was politically expedient. What does that landscape look like? Is more fragmentation across the political spectrum inevitable?
It's all to be seen. It's very early days. Mm. I mean, the coalition only happened yesterday, and it's not even, it needs first to go through another members' vote of the SPD in a couple of weeks. But it looks pretty secure that it will be voted in favor. But on Merkel, maybe I'm naive. I think she will go by herself, but also she will get a lot of pressure from her party because her party is very angry. The party thinks that she has hollowed out the conservative ideas. And she has prepared a couple of successes. Interestingly, all of them are female. And they have been in high office, and one has been promoted now into the cabinet. So I think that there will be a succession soon. There is apparently a two-year phase when they want to revise the whole coalition agreement, which might be the time some people say that Merkel might go. But on the SPD, what is interesting is the finance minister. So Olaf Scholz, he is I think an underestimated politician. He is currently still the mayor of Hamburg. He was very efficient there. He was a very efficient secretary general of the SPD, and he's a bit of a dark horse. And people say him going to Berlin and getting that very key post might be a step towards chancellery. So you might see things completely turning round, and we might have an SPD majority again. And at the same time, I mean, the SPD, surprisingly, sometimes things go so quickly. The SPD is now in a good place. Martin Schulz, who everybody hates in the party, is now foreign minister. Okay, he can stay there, he can do whatever. But he has given up the head of leadership of the party, which is now a woman called Andrea Nahles, and she might be able to give the party a new spirit. And then with Olaf Scholz as a finance minister, we might see things developing in a very surprising way.
Robin, just briefly on this, does this have an inevitable impact on that broader pan-European picture? You know, we talk about how Europe's wrestling with Brexit. Presumably the stronger Merkel was, the better, as you said, a galvanising, stabilising influence. What could the ramifications of more pressure on her domestically be for the broader bloc, do you think?
It makes the picture even more complex and even more uncertain. I mean, there will be stresses, I suspect, within the coalition in Berlin over Brexit negotiating strategy. Martin Schulz, of course, knows Brussels extremely well, having come from the European Parliament. He knows the ins and outs far better than many others. Mm. We have a succession of unstable, fragile European governments. Oddly, in some ways, for the moment at least, the French government looks to be in the best situation, but Macron is an untested politician in many ways. The future is more uncertain than I think it has ever been.
And Stephanie, do you think that the bloc requires, I mean, we talk about the sort of Franco-German axis at the heart and this sort of thing. Can Merkel keep driving a strongly sort of pro-European agenda, or will she almost necessarily be consumed with her domestic challenges, whether they're coming from, you know, her own within her own ranks or from the left even?
I think, I mean, in comparison to Britain, her domestic challenges are not too big. I mean, of course, there is the big, and I don't want to sound complacent. The rise of the AfD, of the anti-immigrant right-wing party, is very worrying. And of course, there is so many unsolved questions around the refugees, the integration of refugees, terrorism. Luckily, we haven't had another terror attack, but there were several terror attacks also by people who came as refugees into Germany. So that's a tricky one. But if you look at the coalition paper, the first chapter is on Europe. So Germany completely commits money and energy into the European project. This is a clear sign to Macron. This is a clear sign that they want to make Europe stable. They don't want more integration necessarily, but they want the euro to work. The joint currency needs to work. And I think in that sense, Germany will, whoever is in power in Berlin, whether Merkel or Scholz or Schulz, it will be pro-European and it will bring stability to Europe.
I'm glad we seem to have arrived at a more positive note.
Slightly more encouraging, isn't it?
There you go. Well, I'll take encouragement from
that. Yes, absolutely.
Robin. That brings us to the end of today's programme. Stephanie Voltzen and Robin Lustig, thank you for joining us here at Midori House for the programme, which was produced by Tom Hall, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Stephanie Sikia. Our studio manager was David Stevens. More music for you next at 1900. Join Andrew Tuck for The Urbanist. We'll have more on the day's main stories on The Monocle Daily, coming your way at 2200. This show's back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Goodbye, and thank you for listening.